This segment of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by Power Women Investing, Ronstadt Insurance, and Mayfield Florists.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for your further listening pleasure.
Direct from the golf course and onto your radio, this is...
Hello, everybody.
The Fred and Jeff Show.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Fred Ronstadt. I'm here with my little brother, Jeffrey.
Hola, Tucson.
And we are celebrating the people, the places, the events, history, and culture that make living in Tucson and Southern Arizona so gosh darn wonderful, Jeff.
That's right, Fred.
And we invite you to visit us at fredandjeff.com, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and even subscribe to this tome of wisdom and entertainment on iTunes.
Yeah.
And you can actually download shows off the website as well.
You can, even on your Android device. Isn't that fun?
Yeah, it is fun.
So did you go to that Monday you were going to go to the guitar? What was it? The guitar experience?
It was a...
Down at Holzklaw?
Master's class.
That's right, the master's class. Did you go?
I missed it.
Jeez, Fred.
I am lame.
You are lame. We had people constantly going, we couldn't find Fred for those PETA Jungle gift certificates.
Yeah, we'll have to do something else for that.
Nice because, work.
Yeah, you know, I was engaged in other stuff. I went to the gym. And about 9 o'clock, it was like, I think I should have been somewhere. But see, this is one of my many flaws, is I cannot schedule things to save my soul. So I forgot to put it on the calendar, and the rest is history. The rest is history.
Well, that's okay.
But yeah,
that just means you got a pocket full of PETA Jungle gift certificates to give away.
That is true.
Yeah,
a pocket full meaning three.
Right. So we'll give away some today.
We will give some away today.
So what's going on out there other than wrapping up the Accenture Match Play today?
Yeah, and wrapping up the rodeo.
The rodeo, right. The Gem and Mineral Show is coming to an end as well.
Yeah, a lot of things coming to an end, but a lot of things happening. And I would be remiss, my little brother, if I didn't remind you that we have just over a month to get in shape.
Oh, boy.
For the Hard Charge Mud Run, which is a four-mile run with 20 obstacles that you and I need to overcome on March 29th.
I could probably do it right now.
Yeah, I could too.
With a belly full of monkey burger.
Yeah, I bet you could.
Couple of, prickly pear iced teas. I think I'm ready to go.
Yeah, no problem. No problem whatsoever.
I'd probably be puking my guts out by the second challenge, but hey, let's go.
Let's do it.
Hard charge, baby.
So, and we also want to thank our friend Brian Chumler with X Racewear for hooking us up with this because...
Don't be so quick to thank Brian. Because we got to do it. Let's thank him. Let's see if we want to thank him
He's already given us, you know, the shorts and the shirts.
Oh, that's true. Thanks, Brian.
And they're really cool because
Nice.
They have little mesh things in front where you can put your running numbers into.
You can put your stuff in there, yeah. What was that old Saturday Night Live skit? What's this box for? You can put your weed in it. So inappropriate.
That's way long ago.
Way long ago. I know. That I'm dating myself.
Let's see. March 2nd. You're talking about stuff in March. It's crazy.
Because it's almost March.
It is almost March. So on March 2nd, Puppets Among Us are having guest puppeteers come into the big theater over there.
Is that correct? Puppets Among Us are having or Puppets Among Us is having?
Well, Puppets Among Us is a bunch of people.
Yeah, but it's a... organization.
So this is why I used to get beat on a regular basis by the nuns at St. Pete's.
Again with the nuns.
So
you got to let it go.
Puppets Among Us is having guest artists come in to do Little Red Riding Hood.
Very cool.
And I know I'm going to butcher this name because that is my that's my role in this radio experience is to butcher names. But the Ulan Spiegel Puppet Theater. And I think that's pretty close
to being
right.
That's pretty darn good.
Is doing the show. It's one show, Sunday, March 2nd at 4 p.m. Go to puppetsamongus.org to get more information. I'm sorry, puppetsamongus.com to get more information and sign up or get some tickets. And these shows are just phenomenal. The talent is just crazy. On March 29th and 30th, they have the Desert Heat experience with the Southern Arizona Rocketry Association. This is their big annual program where they spend 2 days from 9 to 5 on Saturday the 29th and from 9 to 1 on Sunday launching gazillions of model rockets. And it's pretty cool. Not only that, but on March 29th, Saturday, from 6 to 9, there's like a little hour break. From 6 to 9, they have a night launch.
Cool.
So you get to see these rockets, you know, launching at night. So I guess all you really see is the flame.
So we should really share with our listeners why we talk about this rocketry. Because, you know, when you're growing up in Tucson back in the 70s, and there's not a lot of things to do when you're like 8, 9, 10, and you go down to the hobby store and you buy some of these Estes rockets, and you build them, you shoot them off, then you spend the next week out in the desert looking for them.
That's right.
And invariably, they're stuck up in a Palo Verde tree somewhere.
Or top of a saguaro.
And then you got to beg your mom and dad, please take me back to the hobby store so I can get another one.
Yeah.
And that's how we spent a lot of our time.
Launching rockets,
yeah.
Now, speaking of rockets, there is a rocket leaving our humble blue sphere, and that is the OSIRIS-REx.
Right. Which is very cool. And folks, if you missed the OSIRIS-REx show, just go to friendjeff.com and search. You could search the OSIRIS-REx show and listen to these amazingly intelligent gentlemen.
Not us.
Not you and I. But it's just to give you an idea, they are shooting a rocket off. It's going to go millions of miles away. It's going to catch up to an asteroid, OSIRIS-REx.
No.
OSIRIS-REx is the asteroid.
No.
Oh, it's the rocket?
Yeah.
Okay. It's gonna
see, this
it's gonna
is, you're demonstrating this how, thing. You're demonstrating how we are not the smart guys in the room.
What?
You are demonstrating how we are not the smart guys in the room.
What?
Yeah.
All right. It's going to orbit this asteroid like 100 zillion times.
For like a year.
Land on it. Yeah, for a year. Land on it. And then take off again.
Get a sample. And then take off.
And then return back to Earth. And come home. So that's crazy.
Yeah. So the asteroid is actually named Bennu.
Bennu. That's it. You're right. Bennu.
And one of the things we're promoting is you can send a message to Bennu through the Planetary Society. So if you go to the planetarysociety.org and you can sign up and there's going to be a DVD with your name. Fly into an asteroid and then coming back.
Yeah, but if this asteroid is going so fast, how are they going to deposit that DVD on the asteroid and have it stay there?
I don't know if they're going to deposit the DVD or not, but it's taking a ride. So your name will take a ride in space.
That's
but like
pretty
right,
cool.
Right now, my name is on a probe around the moon.
It's also in a bathroom stall at Bob Dobbs.
Yes, it is. And I appreciate that because I get lots of calls from friendly people. I don't know exactly what they're asking for. But they're really nice folks.
Is this Fred? I heard you were really good.
And my name's on Mars.
Mars, yes.
So I am truly out there.
Yes, you are. Congratulations.
The last thing I got on my list is we want to remind folks, Happy Tuesday is happening over at the Loft Theater, 9 o'clock Tuesday night. Every Tuesday they have experimental comedy, and this week is the Lonely Hearts Club.
And congratulations to the Loft for raising money.
Yeah, they raised over $300,000.
That's right. And with a matching grant of another $250,000.
Yeah. Yep.
So the Loft is really coming on. You know what?
And that's...
I took Larry to the farmer's market there last weekend, and we got some local honey, the Happy Bear honey. The farmer's market was fantastic. And when we were getting ready to leave after we purchased all of our stuff, a gentleman came up to us and said, you know, we've got free cartoons inside for the kids. So Larry and I went inside and watched like 4 or 5 old Popeye the Sailor Man cartoons. It was fantastic.
Sweet. That is nice.
It was a lot of fun.
So lots of stuff going on. We, you know, we don't have the time to mention it. I guess we do. We could spend the whole hour mentioning it.
Yeah, we got a fun guy to talk to today.
Yeah, so go to fredandjeff.com. There's a community calendar there. And there's just tons of stuff going on in our wonderful, in the old Pueblo.
Yep. So, folks, stick around. We got lots more to talk about here on The Fred and Jeff Show.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood.
hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
This portion of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by Anthony Cigar Emporium, the Downtown Tucson Partnership, and Sleeping Frog Farms.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
This is the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Fred Ronstadt. I'm here with my little brother Jeffrey.
Hola, Tucson.
And we are celebrating the people, the places, the events, history, and culture that make living in Tucson and Southern Arizona so wonderful. And with us today is one of those folks who make our community a great place to live, work, and play, is Dr. Charles Raison, who is a associate professor with the College of Medicine over at the University of Arizona. He's got a bunch of other titles that we can talk about as well, but he's here to talk about compassion.
Hello, Chuck.
Hey, how are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm okay.
Are you using your compassionate voice right now?
I am. Well, I'm using my recovering from the flu voice.
Actually. Oh, yeah. I had that a couple weeks ago. It was horrible.
Yeah, you know, it does.
Terrible, terrible. So, Chuck, tell our listeners, where are you from?
Well, originally I'm from Central California near Fresno. Grew up in a little bitty farming town, you know, no movie theater, no restaurants. I mean, really middle of nowhere. But I've lived all over the country. I think I've lived in like 15 cities at last count.
So. No kidding.
Yeah.
And you're just like one step ahead of the law kind of thing?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. They're out there in Texas. I think I've got them off the trail for a while.
So, young kid growing up in California, where'd you go to college?
Stanford.
You went to Stanford. And yeah. What degree did you get at Stanford?
I got a degree in anthropology.
Anthropology?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I still use, actually. Many of my collaborators are anthropologists, including at Arizona. It's interesting. One of my main collaborators studies how running and walking caused the human brain to evolve the way it did. I wish I was an anthropologist, actually. But you are.
You had a degree in anthropology.
Undergrad.
Undergrad,
but
okay.
I don't have the PhD or anything really official, unfortunately.
So how does running and walking,
how does that work? Well, so it turns out there's a lot of evidence now that humans were able to kill very large animals a long time ago, proto-humans, back when their brains were still really small.
What's a proto-human?
Yeah, you know, like some of the things from which we come, like Homo erectus and some of these, you know, kind of things on the way from an evolutionary perspective to being humans. And so this idea evolved that maybe humans evolved the ability to run before they evolved these big thinking brains, because it turns out humans are very unique in the way we run. We're the only animals that have this capacity. They have these feet that have these kind of really remarkable arches that we don't use for anything but running. So these guys begin to think, well, maybe humans, the other thing we have that's really quite remarkable is the ability to keep our body temperature very constant under really extreme conditions. Most animals can't do that. You know, your dog, you know, for 200 yards, he can run you down five times over, but take him out in the middle of summer, run for a while, and especially big dogs, right, they flop down, they're finished. Most animals can't run and lose heat at the same time because they can't pant and run. And so it turns out, and there's some beautiful videos of this with some of these, you know, remaining hunter-gatherers, the humans can run faster, further, longer than any other animal in the world. Humans can routinely beat horses. In fact, they almost do every year in this 100-mile race out in California. So there's this wonderful footage of these sort of, you know, very, very ancient, like, bushmen. They'll run like the wildebeest or the gnu or whatever. You'll see them and just keep at it. They just keep at it hour after hour after hour. And eventually the animal just turns around, falls over dead of heat exhaustion. Then they go up, bang it. And so the idea is that this thing called endurance hunting was really the thing that began this sort of march of human brain evolution, because then all of a sudden it provided this ability to have huge amounts of meat, which has huge, you know, protein and massive calories. And then they had to develop all these sort of, you know, social abilities to hunt together, to keep the animal moving all the time and all this stuff. Dave Reichlin, who's a fascinating fellow, he'd be another guy you should interview, is my anthropology buddy, who is really one of the kind of leaders on this. So anyway, I have a great interest in how the body talks to the brain. And I think that there's a lot of things that we can tap into, in physical things that can help our mental attitude. I think the opposite's true too, but this is my anthropology works a lot around, can we rediscover how humans across long periods of time, moved and ate and acted, and can we bring some of it back to the modern world? And by doing that, maybe help our mental state.
Yeah, there's still examples, if I remember correctly, of Bushmen in Africa that, you know, they run and don't get winded.
Yeah.
And that's how they communicate. I mean, just
unbelievable
distances.
Yeah, or, you know, just south of here, you know, down in Mexico, the Tarahumara, this tribe that live in the Copper Canyon, these guys would take off and do these 250-mile nonstop races. Men, women, children, guys in their 70s or 80s, they still do it. I was down there years ago when it was still safe to be down there, and I remember being down at the bottom of that canyon. You hear this sort of whoosh, and you'd look and you'd see this ghost of a person go boosho through the trees, you know. Crazy, right. So this is something in many traditions, including Native American traditions, the Navajo and the Hopi, many traditions have this sort of running as not only a sort of pragmatic means of doing things, but as a spiritual exercise also.
Well, there was some traction here not too long ago about helping the Native Americans that live in southern Arizona to pick running back up because diabetes and obesity and all those things had kind of run rampant throughout the tribes.
Yes, absolutely.
That if they could get these kids to start running again and alter their diets, they could get them back to a very, very healthy state.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. I'm a big believer in that. I think that, you know, humans are really kind of a particular kind of animal. You know, I study evolutionary processes. I know sometimes people quibble about evolution, but you know, from a scientific perspective, you know, we humans, we're certain kind of animals. We're very unique. You know, we other than the insects, we're like the most social animals in the world. We have these unique abilities to run long distances. We can keep our body temperatures regular over amazing amounts of degree changes. And I think that a lot of these things, which we've had now for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, have been screwed up or lost in the modern world. You know, we're really out of kilter.
Because of our
diet? Because of our diet, our sleep patterns, the fact that we don't move anymore, that everything is done for us. You know, necessity is the kind of mother of invention. And a lot of things that people wouldn't choose to do, they had to do. People didn't want to run all the time usually. They didn't, you know, but they had to. And that had to sort of kept them in line, you know, and because they, to survive, they had to have certain sort of social relations. People tended to have these very intense bi-directional social relationships with a small group of people. They tended to exercise a lot. They tended to eat food by necessity that we know is now very healthy, right? But it was all a lot of hard work. And, you know, humans were highly inventive. Over time, we've just used our big brains to keep inventing. And we've invented ourselves into this sort of luxurious hell in many ways, you know.
Well, I think the really good example of that is if you ever saw the Disney movie WALL-E.
I was going to say, I was going to actually invoke WALL-E for just that. Right. We're heading toward WALL-E, right? That, you know, where everybody's so fat they can't move and we're going to need prosthesis to do these simple things,
normal,
you know.
Tasks, yeah. I mean, the whole school of thought that we've, you know, invented ourselves into death, essentially.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's increasing evidence that something like that might actually be true. Why we need to combat it. This is why a lot of the work we do is aimed at trying to recover some of these more ancient ways of being and injecting them in intelligent ways into the modern world so that we can better tolerate the modern world.
Wow, that's crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But I mean, but you would think that just looking at pictures of our ancestors and then pictures of folks today, it's all in front of us.
Oh, amazing. You know, I used to go up and watch the dances up in Hopi Land back in the 70s, you know, and the Kachinas were all thin. Man, you know, I went up there a couple of years ago, and, you know, the Kachinas have developed a real metabolic issue, you know. And that was a moment where it really hit me that all of us have just had this sort of massive expansion. There's so many things we could talk about that we do for our comfort that are bad for our long-term well-being. That it's just stunning.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
And to change that perspective, to change that mindset is, I think, a lot of people are out there looking for that silver bullet to do it easily, but it's not.
Well, they want a modern solution.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
You know,
can you put it in a pill? Exactly. Right. That's part of the challenge. You're right.
That's crazy. So you graduate from Stanford.
Yep.
And from Stanford, you headed to?
Houston. Chased a woman. Got a job as a journalist. My family owned a little newspaper for really 100 years almost. Just a weekly. One of the last weeklies actually owned by a family in California. So I worked as a journalist. I interviewed people. That was what you guys are doing now. That was my first job, you know, which was great for eventually becoming a psychiatrist. But I really thought I was going to be a novelist. So then I packed up and moved to Denver and started a PhD program in creative writing. discovered I had no ability to write novels whatsoever and that I hated it with a passion. Oh, man, talk about miserable. You know, that blank page is horrible.
So the great American novel is not coming from you.
It ain't coming from me, man. I it's funny. One of my buddies turned out to be this sort of, in literary circles, this very famous novelist, a guy named Reg McKnight. And I saw stories that went on years later to win huge awards in little mimeograph forms. And one of the stories made me quit. You know, I was in a workshop with this guy and, you know, it was all messed up and crappy, and I read the story and I said, oh, I gotta quit, you know,
because he was that good.
Oh, it was terrible. I was that bad.
That reminds me of the story that there's a U of A football player who's now a great community guy. His name is Jay Dobbins.
Yeah.
And at his NFL combine, he was up against a very little known receiver or a prospect who just blew his doors off, and he looked at this guy and goes, this guy's really nobody and I can't beat him. Well, the guy turned out to be Jerry Rice.
Oh, no.
But that's what led Jay to leave his NFL career and start other things. So
it's same, yeah.
Crazy. All right. So, Chuck, we got lots to talk about. We got to take our break here at the bottom of the hour. Folks, stick around because I really think you're going to enjoy the second part of our show talking about compassion training with Dr. Chuck Raison. So stick around for more here on The Fred and Jeff Show.
Run to set you free. Run, baby, run.
This portion of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by Barker Morrissey Contracting, Casa de la Luz Hospice, and 1702 Craft Pizza and Beer.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
This is the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Fred Ronstadt. I'm here with my little brother, Jeffrey.
Hola, Tucson.
And we are celebrating the people, the places, the events, history, and culture to make living in Tucson and Southern Arizona so gosh darn wonderful, Jeffrey.
Correct, Fred.
And we invite you to...
Excuse me.
Yeah. You're interrupting me.
Wow, sorry about that.
Stop doing that.
Should not have had that big sip of tea before we went on.
Is that tea? I thought it was bourbon.
No, it's prickly pear.
Oh, okay. So anyways, we invite you to visit us at fredandjeff.com, follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and even subscribe to this tome of wisdom and entertainment on iTunes. Now, Jeffrey.
Yes, Fred.
Before the break, we were talking to Dr. Charles Raison, who's a associate professor at College of Medicine at the University of Arizona. And, you know, one of the things we like doing, you know, part of our moniker is celebrating the people, is talk about some of the folks who live in Tucson, work in Tucson, and especially, not that we're limited to, but the University of Arizona is a huge fountain of folks who are making our community and the world a better place.
Right. Yeah, because we had Dr. Gashan on a couple of weeks ago talk about how they're doing amazing things with DNA sequencers and helping children fight cancer and adults fight cancer.
Yeah, we've had
U of A.
Yeah, we've had the dean of the College of Science. We've had all sorts of folks. One of my favorite shows is still The Snake Show.
The Snake Show is excellent. I like the Bobcat Show too. Remember the Bobcat Show?
Yeah.
Bobcat Show was good times. So, folks, we live in such a great community, and one of the reasons it's so great is because of the U of A, and not just because the basketball team's so good and the football team's getting good and the baseball team and the softball team, but because there are people down at the U of A doing amazing things that are changing the world to be a better place.
Yeah.
And with that said, one of those guys is here in the studio with us today, Chuck Raison. Chuck, earlier, you know, in the last part of the interview, you were talking about how you moved to Houston to follow a girl.
How did that work out?
It didn't.
Okay. Yeah, see, that's...
Fred always has to bring that.
Yeah.
No, you know, it's funny because every story you know of some guy chasing a girl moving never works out. Never pans out.
Didn't work out.
So I'm just
thanks, Fred,
I'm
doing for ripping open that old scar.
No, it's data. I'm collecting data.
So then you go to Denver, decide that you're not going to write the world's greatest novel. Right. And at that epiphany, at that moment when you check that one thing off the list that you know you're not going to do, where did you go from there?
Well, I was really confused for a while, but then I was actually on a highway between Corpus Christi and Houston. I was down in Houston again on a trip Day Before Christmas, 1984, and I had this like completely bizarre sort of instant revelation I was going to be a psychiatrist. I had no idea.
What song were you listening to on
the
radio?
I wasn't. That's what that is.
Probably some old Merle Haggard song.
Probably. When I left Corpus, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. When I got to Houston, I got out and I said, well, I just got to figure out how to do it. And I had to go back, spend a couple of years in college again to take all the science classes I dodged. I did that in Philadelphia. And then, you know, went to med school. It took like 10, 12 years. But I figured, you know, what else was I going to do with my life? It wasn't like I was, you know, the years were going to pass anyway. So,
Someone said that to me once. He said, you know, you're going to be 40 one day.
You might as well do something. Huh?
Might as well make some of your life.
Yeah, you know, it's like joining the military. You go to med school, you don't have to worry about anything for a while. So then I lived in St. Louis, went to medical school at WashU. And then I was determined to do my residency on the East Coast, but I went to L.A., to UCLA, on a day in December, and it was like one of these days, you know, and I'd been in horrible weather for so long that I literally snapped. I just said, that's it, I'm coming back to California. And so I ended up at UCLA, and I spent about 9 years there finishing residency and then becoming a faculty person. And then there was another woman.
The other woman.
Chased after again. And that brought me, that was one of the things that brought me to Atlanta. And I was at Emory for a long time.
Emory University.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what were you up to at Emory University?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was at UCLA, a lot of what I did was treat people that were medically sick. I wasn't a researcher at all back then, actually. I saw patients, you know, thousands of patients a year.
And you taught.
And I taught. Yes, I taught every day. I taught to residents. I taught. But I got really, really interested in sort of like the beginning of this interest in how the body and the mind talk to each other. And I always had a sort of hobbyist interest in Eastern religion. And so I just started, I was hanging around this Buddhist place down in Long Beach. And through this weird set of circumstances, I got asked kind of impulsively if I would try to organize a huge fundraising dinner for the Dalai Lama's sister.
What's her name?
Her name is Jetson Pema. And
Dalai Lama,
no.
D-O-L-L-Y.
She's a wonderful woman. She looks a little bit like the Dalai Lama in drag. I mean, she's really, it's freaky. She looks like the Dalai Lama with long hair.
Wow.
And she had built up this huge school system for all the Tibetan people in exile, you know, from Tibet. She was coming to L.A. and they were trying to raise money. So I had a crazy story of how I put this thing together. We hosted this big fundraiser. But anyway, that was my entree into the world of the Tibetans. And I became very good friends with one great Tibetan scholar in particular who I brought onto the service at UCLA. And he basically, over the couple of years, sort of gave me this intensive sort of course on everything from their culture to their religion to their gossip. I mean, it was great, you know. And I got very, very interested in some of their meditation techniques, not as a practitioner, but I thought from a Western perspective that these guys were doing things with their body and their brains that were changing how they worked in ways that might help us understand how to treat depression. I've always been into this sort of how do you treat mood disorders. And so I developed this like obsessive fascination with trying to study some of their very advanced techniques. And it wasn't really, UCLA wasn't the place to do it. There was a woman who wanted to leave L.A. And it turned out that Emory had this wonderful combination of things, had this great program in psychiatry studying mind-body stuff. And it had this emerging, very powerful Tibetan Buddhist presence as a result of my now longtime friend and collaborator, a gentleman named Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Nagi, who for many years had been a Tibetan Buddhist monk who'd been sent over to Emory by the Dalai Lama to form an institute. And that in itself is this astounding story of how this guy could barely speak English, shows up knowing nobody, and, you know, fortune was on his side. So I packed up, I left California, which I came to regret. I love the West so much, but moved to Emory, and really that was the sort of the birth of the second career. It was a against the odds, long shot, remarkable thing that I sort of was able to become this, you know, sort of very, you know, reasonably successful researcher, and that launched my research career.
Well, let's talk about that. So you get this crash course on Tibetan culture.
Right.
And along with that comes this crash course of how the mind and the body interact.
Absolutely.
How do the mind and the body interact?
Well, you know, most people, I think most people take for granted the fact that the body influences the mind, you know. And a lot of people now are fascinated by this idea that the mind can influence the body, which
now,
is...
when you say the mind
or
the
brain,
body influence the mind.
Yeah, well, like, so for instance, you get sick, you know, you don't think so well, or, you know, something happens to your physical body. Everybody knows that, you know, for instance, when your body dies, it's, you know, you know, at least you're not around here anymore brain-wise, right? But, you know, now there's a lot of interest that your emotions can influence your physical health. And that's where a lot of the field has been for the last, you know, 15 years. But I was always interested in how the body affected the mind and the brain. And what got me going with the Tibetan Buddhist stuff was a lot of their advanced practices have exactly the same perspective. They think that bodily processes can be harnessed to drive mental functioning in ways that you can't do with the brain alone. So, you know, what my monk buddy in L.A. said to me was, you know, Chuck, you think about if you want to try to achieve enlightenment just using your mind. He said it takes like trillions of years because think about how flighty the mind is. You know, you're in a pretty good space and then all of a sudden you have a thought and boom, you're off and
you're
gone.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he said, we believe you can use the energies of the body to drive the mind into these very, very stable emotional states that will then sort of basically contain the mind and put it in a state where it's not going to wander as much. Now, I had spent so many years working with people that had been, and the state they were interested in producing was this very, very intense euphoric state. Well, I had spent years working with people that had manic depression, and that's a perfect description of mania, right? And so, actually, I began to think that these guys...
Wait. Yeah, yeah. Give us that perfect description of mania.
Well, you know, mania is a state where you're basically super hyperactive, you're euphoric, you're driven, you're not sleeping. You get this sort of fixed mental state that tends not to be disrupted by negative influences like the police throwing you in jail and stuff.
Or getting
like that.
Hungry.
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Forget it. All that's out the door, right? You know. These guys really were trying to produce, it seemed to me, a state that was a little bit analogous to that, but contained and functional, and in their case, they thought transformative. So, you know, I thought, man, these guys, they're onto the same thing, that there's things that you can do, that bodily processes can be harnessed, the energy of the body can be harnessed to put the brain in certain states. And I don't know why that fascinated me so much, other than I think I'd seen so many patients that were grossly manic that I'd seen these unbelievable phenomena. I mean, I've seen things that the average person would never believe, what the human brain is capable of producing when the whole organism is in one of these driven states.
Give me an example.
Well, you know, not sleeping for 5 or 6 days.
And being functional?
Oh, yeah. Running around, tons and tons of energy, often with very delusional thoughts. You know, I had a patient once that thought that she was Eva Braun, Hitler's girlfriend, but she also was convinced she was the Virgin Mary. You know, crazy stuff. I saw guys that spent millions of dollars in a single week, you know. Oh, yeah, unbelievable stuff.
And
know?
All this manic.
All this energy, this driven manic energy, right.
Is driven by what?
Well, it's the brain and body go into a state of overdrive that we don't quite understand. In the old days, about 10, 15, 20% of people would die of that condition when it was really severe because we didn't have ways of treating it with medications.
And they just kind of burn themselves out?
Burn themselves out. Yeah, they've dropped out of a heart attack usually.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so the Tibetans feel
So the Tibetans had sort of some of their deeper tantric practices really seemed to tap into some of these same bodily energies, which they also felt were very explosively powerful and had to be managed very carefully. And in fact, you know, Geshe Lobsang and I at Emory, we tried for many years to study these advanced practitioners, and they would never let us study them.
Why?
Well, they'd been treated badly by some scientists in the West, you know, and so they'd all taken a death vow that they'd kill themselves before they'd ever let themselves be studied again.
Seriously?
Oh, yeah, it was an uphill battle. I got myself all the way to the head abbot of the one monastery where they really do these advanced practices. And interestingly, this abbot had a thing for Brazilian steakhouses because he'd been to South America. So I brought these two guys in robes, these two Tibetan Buddhist monks, to the steakhouse, the Brazilian steakhouse in Atlanta. That was worth it. That's the kind of thing I live for, right? You know, the whole restaurant stops. But anyway, the head abbot, we made our pitch that we really wanted to study these guys. He didn't say yes. He didn't say no. He just, all of a sudden, he said, you know, one of our great meditation, this thing called Tuma, one of these great meditation masters was traveling in India to see the holy sites. I said, yeah. He said, well, you know, he was always around people, so he could never practice. I said, oh, well, that's rough. He said, but finally, you know, one day he snuck off by himself. I said, uh-huh. And he said, and he began doing this very deep tantric practice under a tree. And I said, that's interesting. And then the abbot said, you know what happened? A goat came along, started watching him. I said, yeah. And he said, you know what happened to the goat? I said, no. He said, the goat went blind. And I realized I was the goat, right? Going around trying to watch these guys and poke my nose in their business. We gave up. that work at that moment, actually. Wow. Geshe Loeb Tsong and I, you know.
And they just were not going to.
Yeah, they weren't going to. They just.
Yeah, yeah. They don't give you a straight answer. It's always.
Yeah, but they just weren't going to let it
they
happen.
They weren't
going
to let it happen. No, they didn't want to be studied. And I think partly because they were concerned that some of these very advanced practices, you know, they need to be done a certain way. I actually do think I've seen people whose minds have been destabilized by trying to do them, because I do think they have ways of evoking whatever it is that puts people in these sort of amazing states, you know, that can then go very south, you know, very sour if folks aren't careful.
Wow. You know? Okay, we got to take a quick break. Folks, we'll be right back. We have more, much more to talk about with our limited time, so stick around for more here on The Fred and Jeff Show.
This portion of the Fred and Jeff Show is brought to you by H&S Estate Garden, the Flight Grill at Pima Air and Space Museum, and PETA Jungle.
Now, time for more of the Fred and Jeff Show on 104.1 The Truth.
This is the Fred and Jeff Show. This is Fred Ronstadt. I'm here with my little brother, Jeffrey.
Hola, Tucson.
And we are still celebrating the people, the places, events, history, and culture that make living in Tucson and Southern Arizona so gosh darn wonderful. And one of those people is Dr. Charles Raison, who is a associate professor in the College of Medicine at the University of Arizona. And we've been talking, Jeffrey, about meditation, depression, mania, and we're going to get to compassion, I guess,
yeah,
eventually.
Yeah, and so you were called a blind goat.
More or less. I've been called that before, by the way.
Probably by your wife,
shocker,
right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah. So where did you go from there? Now you're like, well, I can't do that. So
well,
now
it was
what
really
do we do?
Quite an interesting thing. At just that moment, fortunately, a very famous researcher who was at Emory, who studied the systems that we thought might be involved in some of this advanced meditation, said to me, Chuck, yeah, forget the darn meditation. You know, why don't you do some real science? And if the meditation comes along, it'll come along. But, you know, work with me and I'll get you trained up on the science. Best decision I ever made, because for about 2 or 3 years, I just did nothing but learn science and began doing other studies that were more sort of mainstream science. And then a couple of years later, all of a sudden, because there had been this little rash of student suicides at Emory, the college approached Geshe Loeb Tsong, my colleague, my buddy, wondering whether or not some kind of meditation study might be done to help college kids with depression, anxiety, and stress. So, boom, there we were. We were all of a sudden in business, and Geshe Loeb Tsong said, well, what kind of meditation do we want to do? And we talked about stuff, and because I had done all this science, I knew that people that had more compassionate outlooks on life, people that had better connections with other people who were not as isolated, that were not as hostile, had lower levels of these immune inflammatory chemicals that we've studied very much over the years.
And that's the stuff you were talking about at the College of Science series downtown.
That's right. That's right. Well, I've done a lot of studies on the relationship between the immune system, this inflammatory stuff, and how the brain functions. And we know that inflammation in general makes people depressed, et cetera, for heart attacks, for dementia, for strokes, for cancer. And stress increases inflammation. And so do all these sort of negative or isolative social stuff. So I said to Geshe Loeb Tsong, because I knew a lot about Tibetan practices, I said, why don't we study compassion meditation? Because of all the practices in the world, it's the most rigorous training I've ever heard of for how to change your mental attitude towards other people in ways designed to make you more accepting and more compassionate. And he said, sounds good to me. And so I agreed to do the science part, and he took this, you know, 1,000-1,500-year-old tradition, boiled it down to initially a 6-week training session that we did for undergrads, for freshmen at Emory. And we did this big study, and we showed that the more they practiced this, the more and more of a drop they had in their inflammation when they were put in a stress situation in the laboratory. They didn't get as upset. They didn't get as inflamed. They didn't get as much stress hormone. And so it is very powerful evidence that if you engaged with compassion training, you could do these things that we know protect you from getting depressed, getting heart attacks, diabetes. And that's how this whole thing started, actually.
One of the things you said in a prior conversation was that the brain tricks the body.
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about is is strengthening the brain through this meditation.
That's right.
So that the brain can't trick the body to get sick.
Right, and it also basically, so what we think is happening, and we've done brain scan studies now that suggest that this practice actually increases the size of certain key brain areas, one of which is really important for sort of getting a hold of your emotions and kind of being rational and not just freaking out when sort of challenging social things happen, you know? And we also know that it just makes people, their brains, smarter at reading and understanding other people's emotions. So I think what's going on is you practice this, it changes your outlook on things. And instead of seeing the world as sort of such a threatening place, you tend to see the world more as a place of opportunities. And what's interesting is from built into this practice is the idea that people that you have conflicts with are actually sources of opportunity. You know, traditionally there were opportunities to learn patience and forbearance and things that were sort of spiritual virtues, but I've always been interested in the fact that just on a practical level, if you can work with people that you have trouble with and figure out how to devise win-win scenarios, those are the people, you know, that's how you're going to benefit in the modern world, right? And so we think that's what's happening is that basically when you do these practices, it helps your brain when it comes into a challenging situation not as instinctively jump to putting the claws out and seeing enemies everywhere, but sort of looking at things in a more open manner, which then decreases stress responses, decreases those inflammatory chemicals, which we know go right back up to the brain and make people feel more stressed out. So something like that's what we think is going on.
Now, you may not be to this point in the research, but is there like some causality stuff where you, instead of training somebody to prevent those, the bad things from happening, find somebody who's like, you know, really a train wreck health-wise and teach them these techniques and see if there's a reversal in their health improves, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so interestingly, you know, we're working very hard to bring this compassion training, which we now call CBCT. You know, you got to have an acronym that sounds official, cognitively based compassion training. We're working very hard to bring it to Tucson. Really, right now it's mostly in Atlanta. We're working with folks up at the University of Wisconsin. But the other place in all the world where this really striking new practice that we hope will get launched is here in Tucson. And my colleagues have actually started a study in the Cancer Center at the University of Arizona where they're actually teaching CBCT or compassion training to females that are survivors of breast cancer. And very often those folks, as a result of either their disease or these treatments, which are really rough, are left with difficulties thinking and concentrating, and they're often unhappy and exhausted. And so, in a way, they're more like the train wreck. And so we'll see how it functions there. We've also done a study in Atlanta of 70 very badly abused and traumatized foster adolescents, so kids in foster care. And again, we found the same thing. The more the kids practice, the better of an improvement we saw in their immune function and their stress function. So we think, and we know that people that come out of those very traumatic upbringings often, you know, on average, they live like 15 years less long than other people. And we think a lot of it's because of this overactivation of these angry bodily systems that damage the body, damage the brain.
Now, Sorry. You guys have brought this to Tucson.
We brought it to Tucson, and we're actually on March 7th through 9th. My colleague Geshe Lobsang, who created the compassion training protocol, is going to be here at an event co-sponsored by the Department of Psychiatry, the School of Social and Behavioral Sciences, and Ben's Bells, actually. We've all gotten together to sponsor a 2.5-day training where Geshe Lobsang is going to actually train people on it's sort of an introductory to this compassion training. And it's open to the public, and a lot of people have signed up, but there's still spaces. The way to do it, if you're interested, actually, is to go to the website www.compassionaz, that's all one word, capital A-Z, .com. And all sorts of information about the class and about the work we're trying to do also.
That's fantastic, Chuck.
Yeah.
So compassionaz.com.
Yep.
Folks can get more information on what you guys are up to,
yep,
as well as sign up for the class that's happening.
Yes. March 7th through 9th.
March
7th
through 9th.
Just in a couple few weeks. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Downtown at the University of Arizona downtown campus.
So what do you guys hope in the long run, what do you hope to find?
Well, I mean, we're interested in continuing to study how it works and some of the scientific stuff. But I think now much of my drive is to make it available to at-risk populations, especially young people. We've been working with several groups in the community that deal with at-risk young people in some native settings, also in some settings, foster care, exploring whether or not we might be able to make it available. And then working with Ben's Bells to explore whether or not either CBCT or some of the principles of CBCT can be brought into classrooms in ways that might transform classroom dynamics. We did a study actually in Atlanta showing that you could change how classrooms behave with CBCT in fourth and fifth graders.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
coming
that's
out,
fantastic.
About to be published. Yeah.
Having a fourth and fifth grader myself, that would be an amazing
thing. Pretty cool, huh?
Well, Chuck, thanks so much
for
pleasure. What you're
doing
in our community.
Oh, my pleasure. Hey, thanks for having
me, guys. Yeah, you're one of the great members of our community. We're happy to have you here.
Well, thank you.
And folks, remember, it's CompassionAZ.com for more information. We'll have it up on the FredandJeff.com website, too. And Fred, what do you want to give away?
Oh, let's give away some roses.
Absolutely.
And maybe even a gift certificate to 1702.
1702 Craft Pizza and Beer. And a dozen roses from Mayfield Florist for the first person that sends Fred an email at fred@fredandjeff.com saying,
I don't know. Who are they going to look forward to seeing at the
Hard Charge event?
No, not Hard Charge. At the Festival of Books.
Festival of Books. Yeah, Festival of Books is coming up.
We got a whole list of authors coming out.
That's right. So whoever you're looking forward to seeing at the Festival of Books, tell Fred. And it might be worth some roses and craft pizza and beer. So, folks, have a great week out there. Remember, get out there and meet your neighbors because that's how you make Tucson a great place to live. And we'll see you next week here on The Fred and Jeff Show.